Hello, everybody, and welcome to the very 287th episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We're back! We've had a Christmas and a New Year. What the hell was that about?
That was me bursting from the wrapping paper that had been surrounding me.
Oh.
I'm an unopened present under the tree, a ball, a large heaving ball.
I did wonder when this large moving sack of wrapping paper arrived at my door today,
yep.
Parked it on the sofa. And then I unwrapped it. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's Matt.
I've been sitting outside your doorstep for a month in the rain, getting soggy, dressed up like an elf, as you can now see.
Mm.
But I didn't arrive in time for Christmas, so I'm here now,
wow.
Emerging covered in tatters of wet paper.
Excellent.
It's me, your Christmas surprise.
Your commitment to the bit is astounding.
Thank you.
On this episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking about just two games. We're going to be talking about Tend, an absolutely massive roll and write game of doing farming and hurting your brain. And we're going to talk about Take Time, a cooperative puzzle game about not communicating and making numbers go up.
Clocks.
First up on this podcast, we're going to talk about a big old game called Tend. This is a game designed by Max Anderson, Zach Dixon, Austin Harrison, and Toby Sarnell, with art by Kelly Nakamura, published by IV Games.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a flippin' right game.
Oh, it's a flippin' fill. I mean, honestly, it's a flippin' get and think and then fill game.
Like, without burying the lead, this is like the largest roll and write, flippin' right, filling in grids and doing pencils and paper type game that has maybe ever existed.
Yes.
It's bigger than Twilight Inscription, which is the Twilight Imperium roll and write game, which, remember that? That's crazy.
No.
I never got
to play that.
The fact that it's bigger than the Twilight Imperium roll and write kind of speaks to how big this game is and how many boxes you have to fill.
Sorry, I just need to roll back a second. I said I never got to play Twilight Inscription as if I'm like not allowed. I haven't played it, right? I just want to make it clear I'm not being held here under duress.
You're not barred from Fantasy Flight
No,
games.
No, no. If I want to play it, I can play it.
Yeah,
that's
you
a
can
me
find
problem,
it somewhere.
Okay? Yeah, this thing is gigantic.
It's
huge. IV Studios now IV Games, they tend to make games that are large, beautiful, and extraordinarily well produced.
Yes.
But sometimes games that we feel mixed about.
Yeah, they're really slick productions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really want to like every single IV Studios
100%.
Game. And I normally like them all right.
Yeah.
And I think I feel kind of the same about Tend.
I think I feel similarly. I think Tend is the closest of the games I've played of theirs to being like, oh, I think this is really good.
Yeah.
But it's slightly marred by the fact that every time I play it, I feel like I'm having an aneurysm.
Which I think is sort of the intent. I think it's a game that's kind of designed to be a kind of overwhelming bonus inducing nightmare game.
I don't know if that was the intention.
Well, when you design a game where you tick a box, and then that box means you tick another box, and then that box means you tick three more boxes, then you roll dice, then you kind of erase some board and do some scratch card nonsense. I think the game wants you to be like, there's so much happening.
I mean, I think this is an interesting one. Like, we were having a conversation off podcast not long ago about cozy games and about how we don't like often cover like cozy board games and about how sometimes, you know, they don't get short shrift from us in terms of like what we cover, because we love things that have orcs in them.
We do.
Well, I do anyway. And, and things that
like
are in shiny boxes. But I do think that like there is something, especially, you know, in the world of video games where cozy games are king. There is a weird like thing where often the games that are depicted as being cozy games actually end up being the most like mechanically
dense.
Like vampiric, you know, in a way of like of getting you caught in these tight little loops.
Yes, I think Tend definitely is that.
And I think the idea of Tend, though, right? So basically, yeah, it's a game where you're flipping out cards, and then these show you the actions that you can take on your turn.
Yes,
but then the complexity of it is that each of these actions is effectively another whole separate board.
Yeah, and we should talk about like the sort of setting for this game. Is it's kind of like a bit Stardew Valley in space is kind of the idea. You have a kind of farm board in front of you that has a little spot to do fishing, a little spot to do mining, a little place where you can grow crops, a little place where you can do upgrades, and ultimately there's a manifest where you can load up on all of these things, like your fish and your plants and your rocks, and you can ship them presumably off world somewhere to get points.
Yeah.
And it is ultimately all those different parts of the board are like different roll and write mini games.
Yes.
So the farming mini game, you put these big chunky dice on the board and they tick up every turn. And when they get to a certain threshold, then boop, you get a pumpkin or a wheat or whatever. And then there's a little fishing game where when you go fishing, you roll some dice that'll give you some coordinates and that'll let you hoik a fish out of the water, which you can then, maybe you can sell it for money to get upgrades, or maybe you can put it in your cargo manifest to get points,
yeah,
etc, etc.
But then and within each of these things,
oh,
so you know, to be a simple one is say that the fishing rods, right? You can upgrade your fishing rods, which means you then, when you roll the dice, you don't just get that exact coordinate that is rolled on the dice. You can choose a fish from an area around it,
right?
But not only that, you can spend resources to unlock different, better fishing spots, so you can get different types of better fish.
I'm gonna go fishing in the cave. I'm gonna get fishing special cave fish
in the river or the grotto. There's like four or five different fishing locations in the game, which is frankly stunning for a game that has like five different areas of things you can be doing.
Yes.
Enticingly, and definitely the thing that first made me go, whoa, 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 this game has scratch cards.
It does have scratch cards.
Sadly, I haven't won any money on any of them yet.
No, but you're holding out hope.
But I'm holding out that I'm going to find those three cherries in the caves at some point. Mining and like forestry in this game are
logging,
both represented by actual scratch cards that are like slightly randomized, and you get a box of like 100 of them, 200 of them. You get a whole stack of these things in the game, and then also there is an app for people who, if you run out, you can use an app to infinitely dig. But frankly, I can't imagine that would happen because I don't know. Like, I'm sure there will be people out there who will play the game physically this much. I think if I did, it would probably take years off of my life.
Yeah. And those people probably aren't listening to this podcast because they're too busy playing 10.
Yes, yes, they
It'd probably be a full-time job getting through 100 of those suckers.
Yeah, a lot of time, a lot of work. But, you know, you have these scratch cards, and it means that when you then like take an action to mine, you're going to actually scratch off a cube, and you're basically doing a kind of like digging video game style thing of removing a cube of something and seeing what's underneath.
Yeah. And then the thing that kind of makes this game, so all of this kind of sounds pretty simple. It's like you go mining and you get rocks and then you put them in your cargo manifest to get points, or you use the rocks to upgrade your mining tools and you can mine more. But the source is that often these different mini games kind of clash and combine in different ways.
Yeah.
Like when you go logging, you might get resources that help you do better fishing, or you might uncover a certain action when you give a gift to a neighbor, which is also a mechanic in the game.
Yep.
And it means that these simple turns, roll and write, flip and write, whatever style, begin to compound into these crazy, crunchy odysseys where you will turn just one simple action into a billion jillion points.
Yeah.
And there is also like, so the system that I really like in Tend, and I kind of, maybe my biggest problem with it is that I wish this system was used a bit more, is the way that you get those actions in the first place.
Yes.
Because, as you alluded to earlier, you deal out these cards for all players to use in a little row, and the cards will give you those basic actions. There'll be a card that says, do a mining action, a card that says, do a chopping action. And at the start of the game, you just have this very basic deck of simple actions. But as it progresses, these extra cards will slide in that have a top part that's like, do a mining or a chopping action.
Uh-huh.
And then a bottom part that says, if you have 5 mega fish in your belly, then you get to do an extra bonus geode or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the thing is that usually you won't be able to do that second part early on in the game. Like, when it first comes up in the market, you'll be like, oh, that's annoying. I haven't got 8 fences in order to do this second thing. But you can remember that those are going to get cycled through the deck, therefore meaning that when they pop up later on, you can then capitalize on them and get twice as many actions.
So each round in the game, effectively, you're adding in some new cards to this deck that you're going to shuffle and then play out cards of 5 things that you can choose from. And each round, you get to do 2 of those cards, basically.
Yes.
So it means that especially in the early game, the things that come up in the first round or two, you're going to see them multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and later in the game, often the things that come out are much more powerful cards. But, you know, you might see them later on again, but you might not. Mm-hmm. And I like that element of kind of like, ooh, is it worth me pushing to do that at this point in the game?
Sure.
Because it could come up again.
Yeah.
But maybe not. Minus, like, the way that I like the way that these cards give the game a shape.
Sure.
And it means that, like, in a way, it's interesting because usually in often in board games, like, you'll go off in different directions slightly, whereas I think these force people into similar directions.
Right.
But there's not really any, like, conflict there.
No.
You're all effectively, like, doing your own... It might as well be doing your own planet.
Yeah, it's basically... This game is almost zero interaction, aside from you giving your friends a random resource, yeah, basically.
Every now and then you get to give your friend a random treat.
Yeah, and that's the only interaction. So most of the interaction in the game is just waiting for other people to be done.
Yes, because it's simultaneous.
Yeah.
But it means that, like, those cards early on, if it says, oh, like, have a fishing thing upgraded, then it means that you're going to have a game now which is going to, if people are all playing, like, well, or optimally, or trying to do well, you're going to have a game where lots of people are doing that in this game.
Which is
kind of fun, because it does mean at least that, like, you all explore the mechanics together at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun. And it also gives you, whilst you're playing, a sense of progress, which I quite liked, in the way it's not a case of getting to the end of the game and going, oh, you did way better than me, even though one person might. You're all trying to do similar things, and so it's quite fun to see, like, oh, you're how are you doing that? And it's kind of there's a nice bit of, like, fun frustration of, like, you've already upgraded your thing.
That's crazy.
In a way that, like, rather than often in games where you have all these different directions you can take, sure, you'd be like, oh, I haven't even looked at that. Like,
yeah, I like that it also does, because of the ways that these different upgrades to the different areas require different things, it means that you sort of have to dabble a little bit
in
most of the systems, maybe not all of them. Like, if there's, say, 5 mini games, you have to play 4 of them reasonably well, and you have to also engage in the whole, like, neighbor system as well. Like, it forces you to kind of run the whole farm, as it were.
Yeah,
which is quite nice.
And especially, like, you know, with that kind of wanting to min-max thing, trying to be very cautious about it, because the game, it's a slow game because it's a lot of thinking, but it does whip along.
Yeah,
and you get to a point where, well, you just don't get that many actions.
You're later always in the doing game, something,
yeah.
Even though you're turning these little actions into lots of actions, and you're doing, like, they're very quick to resolve individually. They're very, like, bitty and satisfying because you're constantly crossing off stuff. And the game does do a really good job because of the production. It does a very good job of making that all feel very satisfying.
Yes.
I think we've got a slightly deluxified version of it.
We do.
That comes with special pens. Pens on one side and little stamps on the other.
Yep.
And stamping those boxes, hooey. It is delightful.
It is. And it's the funny thing that I think one of the interesting elements of where players diverge in this is the fact that the sheets you have, the cargo manifests are different for each player.
Yeah.
So you're going to be like, each player's going to have like a cargo that is more valuable than others.
Yeah.
And because of that, it means that you do end up going in slightly different directions in terms of what resources you're trying to get to put in your manifest to make points, etc.
Sure.
And again, though, there's a fun thing throughout the game where you are like, often you have this like little board, like a menu that shows you what each of the resources is worth, both in terms of cash now and in terms of what is the Tetromino style shape that you can put into your manifest chart for points at the end of the game.
And you can't put two things of the same kind next to each other.
No.
So you can't have two like farm animals slapped in your manifest directly touching. So you have to do some clever little Tetris to make
sure. And you do have to diversify a bit. And you have to be like, okay, well, I need to go and do a mining action now, even though I'm rubbish at it. And those are the turns that kind of feel bad in a nice way of being like, oh, I need some of this though. So I have to go and do an action I'm not even good at.
Right.
And then you have an immediately overtook gun because you haven't upgraded that ability at all.
Yep.
But you need one of these flipping rocks to be able to get this thing.
Get a rock so bad.
I think the thing that makes this like slightly hellish to play, and I it would be worse if it wasn't true, but all of these resources, and there are a lot of resources in the game.
There's a whole bunch.
You know, you've got like two different types of bits of wood you can get, like multiple types of rocks that are just little images, no text. And they don't exist as resources. Anything you get, you immediately spend.
Yeah.
And you spend it by crossing something off.
Yeah.
So even money, even like, oh, well, instead of getting this object, I'm going to get 2 coins.
Yeah.
Coins are resources that you can cross off on your sheet to get things.
Yes. So, and you have to spend them immediately.
Yes. So it gets a little bit maddening when you have a thing where you're like, okay, well, I have one of those, I'm going to put it here, but that unlocks something else, so I have to put that somewhere. And you have this almost chain of not just like, in a roll and write, usually you might have a thing where I get to cross one of these off and then I get to cross a blue one off. But when you have like maybe 15, 20 unique resources,
sure,
you then being like having to kind of hold them in your head, like doing some abacus stuff of like, well, I still have this wood that I need to put somewhere.
And the images are tiny. And I especially found in the like fishing mini game, because you roll dice to get a kind of random fish, I would often be like, oh, I got this fish that I've never seen before.
Yep.
Where can I possibly spend it? And then you're sort of scrutinizing this giant chart,
yep,
trying to find one of these very small fish icons that look pretty similar.
It kind of comes a bit like doing a jigsaw in a way, or spot the difference. Sure. Of like, what can I do with this? You know, where does it go? I mean, it is nice that you can just immediately just chuck it in your manifest for points or get some coins from if you don't know what to do with it. But having to have this little menu that you have to keep checking for like prices and shapes. And it's funny because it is like the other stuff in front of you is like, you know, you have a big kind of A4 paper sheet that is effectively your game board where you're filling stuff in. And then you have these small cards that show you like the different fishing trajectories. Yes. You have your scratch card.
Yep.
Then you have this small cardboard sheet that shows you the pricing for all of the objects.
Right.
Then you have the other small cards that go either side of you that show you what your neighbors want whilst you're playing. You've got a lot of different stuff in front of you, and you really need a lot of table space to even play this with more than two people, for example, because it's a real filler.
It's a real hog.
And even then you end up having this cardboard thing and having to pick it up and put it down and find a place for it almost. Because it's nothing you can learn. It's never like, oh, I say that. Nothing I could ever learn in terms of knowing what all the costs and shapes are and all the things.
Sure, right.
I always have to be like, what do I do with this? Where's this?
How big is this fish? Is it a one space or a two face fish?
It gets around a lot of this by having these medals you can get on your other sheet, because there's two A4 sheets. I forgot there's a second A4 sheet has just arrived. Yeah, there's two A4 sheets, and the second one, which has your manifest on it, also has these trophies, which is a nice way of being like, I don't know what to do with this fish.
I'll just put it towards my fishing trophy.
I guess I'm gonna get this trophy, which gets me points or something.
Yes,
that's a nice get out of jail free card.
It is indeed.
But I did have some points, especially towards the later part of the game, where when these actions get juicier and it's like, hey, you get to take these two actions, and then because you have this bonus, you get these things. I found myself at one point knowing with all of my heart that I had a red certificate item that I could spend somewhere on my sheet,
right?
But I couldn't work out where I got it from. And I was just scanning my things and being like, I felt like I was losing my mind.
Because
I had to prove to myself that I hadn't just invented it from nowhere. I was like, but why do I have it?
Yeah.
And it took me like 5 minutes till I was like, oh, it's from that card. Because you end up having this thing where like you are having to physically carry the existence of objects that you have to spend in your head. I have a wood, I have a certificate, and I have a piece of iron. And then you're just trying to hold that in your head whilst also trying to remember why you have those things and if there's any more admin you need to do. And that's the point where the wheels start to really spin off towards the end of the game, where you're just like all simultaneously holding all this information in your heads.
No one's talking to anybody.
And also because it's simultaneous, you don't get a break.
Yeah.
You're just constantly doing it.
You are. And I feel like that's almost why I think that a lot of people are enjoying this as a solo game. And I feel like that's where it almost might be best.
Yeah.
I can imagine this being just as a little solitary puzzle where you can take notes on a separate sheet.
You can take a break. Or you just walk away
step
for 10
away
minutes.
For a bit. But I think like, I mean, I don't know what it'll sound like to the listeners right now, but I'm worried that we sound like very negative on this game potentially. And I don't think it's necessarily... Because like, I think every time I've played it, I've had quite a nice time.
I like it.
It's just... like there's a lot going on, but it's a kind of satisfying burn.
Oh, 100%.
Like, you're ticking off all these boxes. You're doing nice things. You're kind of building towards these big crunchy turns. My problem with Tendulmo is I just don't know if I like it enough to keep it around, considering it's just heft and bulk.
It is
size.
A big thing. And also, I think it is, you know, for better or worse, it feels very video gamey.
It feels very video gamey.
In a way that, like, it is very, like, tickling those dopamines. it's really enticing. It's really satisfying when you're in it. And, you know, I say it's like kind of brain burning and melty, but that's because it's so engaging that you just lock into it and you're having a delightful time doing this and juggling around. It ekes into that edge of video gameness for me though, where I feel like, am I being compelled like some sort of motor here? Am I in control of my own body anymore while I'm just doing these things? And find it kind of exhausting afterwards. I still really like it. I just feel like again, it kind of reminds me in a way of video games like Stardew Valley of being like, this ostensibly is a game where you've got all these different things you can do and you can just explore and go and have fun. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll go and do a bit of this. But my mind is like, no, You cannot. You are optimizing this. You are crunching. You are mathing it out. You are a machine in a way that feels almost sick in the context of what you're supposed to be doing.
Sure.
Like, hey, nice chill exploration. No, you are going down the mines every day until you collapse.
I think it's definitely different to Stardew Valley, though, because I think Stardew Valley, it doesn't give you... It gives you money, but it doesn't necessarily... You're defining how successful you are in Stardew Valley, whereas this game has very clear benchmarks for how well you are doing in it. So I think it is more driven towards that like optimization pathway.
Oh,
it's less like cozy, take your time, do your thing. It's much more like, here are these concrete goals.
I mean,
that you're
also it's
hit.
Charts and symbols and a cargo manifest.
My God,
it is not like there's no attempt to be like. The joke in it is almost like a kind of alien style like Wutani like. Of being like, you work for the Tend Corporation, and it, like the fact that then it's all this really flat thing. I think the joke is supposed to be that it's really cozy and friendly looking, but it's like you are just like pencil pushers doing spreadsheets, and like that's fine. I think for me, it just comes down to I really like it, but I feel like the cognitive overload of it makes it like too much. And I'll tell you what I found fascinating about this is that. Yeah, we got a deluxified version which has these special pens.
Yeah.
And if anything, I actually think the pens make it not necessarily worse.
Okay.
But harder to play and harder to enjoy.
Right.
Yes, you get that fun little boost of being able to stamp a little symbol in the manifest, which
And that's really fun.
Really awesome.
It's really good.
The downside of that, though, Tom, is that these pens are all double-sided.
Yeah.
Which means every time you need to change to a different color, which you do a lot.
Frequently.
You have to find the right pen, remove the right side of the lid from the pen, and then you can do the thing, and then put the pen back down again.
I see.
I found a hack when I played this game last time. And
one pen in each between each finger?
I smashed everyone in this game of Tend, and I don't think it's because I was good at the game. I think it's because I was so aware of how much cognitive load it was taking just to manage the pens in this bloody game. I say that with love. That... I hacked it by just wearing a shirt and putting them all in my top pocket.
Okay.
So it meant that rather than having to find them on the table, I just always had them and I could look down and I had a place for them.
I see.
It meant that they weren't taking up any of the precious table space. Because like I say, there's just so many components and things in front of you in your player area that removing them slightly made a big difference. And annoyingly, I wanted to try something different. But when we played it, we didn't have these. But the base version of the game just has colored pencils.
It does.
And I think it probably would feel quite different to play...
With the colored pencils.
With colored pencils.
Sure.
Because being able to just pick up a color and do a thing and then drop it without having to find a lid, put the lid on, take the lid back off, because lids take two hands. And in this game, you need to have one hand free just so you can hold the menu with a price list. Like one of your hands is for holding the cardboard, right?
Okay.
So having, I honestly think that the process of having to pick up the cardboard, put it down, pick up the pen, take the, I think it was just so much moving and doing that I think the game would be better with pencils.
Okay. We'll have to try it.
Then
can we deliver our full verdict on 10.
I would die on that hill.
Okay.
That I think colouring in pencils would make the game more chill and more fun.
Sure. Yeah, okay. But I can believe it.
Yeah, that's my hot take. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I like it. I just don't think I'm going to keep it, right?
No.
I think that's maybe both of our takes on 10.
I think it's definitely a really interesting one. And if you tend to disagree with us when it comes to when we talk about the time we talk about solo board games, we'll be like, sometimes we find it hard to understand why you would do that when you could just play a video game.
Sure.
And lots of people are like, no, I don't agree with that. If you're one of those people, then I think 10 might really be great for you.
Yeah.
I think you might love it.
Next up, we are going to talk about Take Time.
Mm.
This is a cooperative game designed by Alexei Piovesan and Julian Prothier, with art by Maud Chalmel, published by Libellant. And it is a cooperative game in which you are trying to play cards in a circle without communicating. We played this at PAX Unplugged and we had a good time and we found it quite difficult. We were sat next to a table of people who were playing it and having a great time and doing a lot better than us.
We sucked at
it.
And I really enjoyed that because we ended up basically smack talking them.
Yeah.
Like inverse smack talking.
When we did one of them.
We didn't know these people and we hadn't really even talked to them, but they were basically doing well and then we we were like, oh yeah, just we're just talking a lot of crap about them. And then when we did one, we were like,
yes!
Yeah, we were like, you suck.
In
yeah,
your face!
We didn't know who these people were at all. It turned out afterwards that they did know who we were and they enjoyed our work, which was a nice moment. But I was kind of enjoying the bit up to that where we were just being some really poorly behaved British people.
Yeah.
I mean, they knew it was in jest.
Yeah.
They knew that we were trying to like hide the fact that we jokingly hide the fact that we were absolutely terrible at a game that they were killing.
Our kind of faux jealousy at how efficient a team they were being and how
and we were kind of cheating a lot. We kept getting confused and people saying things and then we had to say, "You can't say that." And people go, "Why can't you say that?" And it's like we really just fundamentally were not getting the game. However, whilst doing that, it was still very clear to us that it was a cool thing.
Yes. And I then picked it up afterwards and have been playing a bunch of it. Although this game does have a fatal flaw. So it's a kind of scenario-based game. You have these 40 levels to play through. I'll explain how the game works in just a second. But I have ended up playing the first four levels of this game
a million times.
Because I keep introducing it to new people, being like, oh, this game is cool. But it's kind of impossible to just jump into the deep end.
Yes.
Because it explains its systems kind of slowly in a way that makes a lot of sense. But I've played those four missions.
It's kind of a campaign game.
In a way. It has all these different sort of levels you can play through. And what I found in playing it is the levels don't necessarily get like flat harder over time. It's not like an upward trend.
Uh-huh.
It's like they just test a different skill.
Yes.
They kind of force you to approach the puzzle in a different way. But the difficulty is relatively consistent.
Uh-huh.
So the way this game works is it's going to be a little abstract to try and explain it on the pod, but I'll give it a shot. In the middle of the table, you have a circle, a disc of paper, cardboard, and around that, you are going to be playing some cards. The disc is segmented into six individual sections, and you must play cards into each of those sections following some important basic rules.
Mm-hmm.
Rule number one, all your cards are going to be played face down. Rule number two is that each segment must be higher than the next one in mm-hmm. order. So if the first segment's value is one, the next one has to be one or two, and then two or three, and so on and so forth. And then the final rule is that each one of these segments must maximum have a value of 24.
Yes.
And those are the sort of very basic rules. And from those rules, you are going to get a hand of three cards from these decks that have white cards and black cards that go from 1 through 12. Shuffle that up, deal it out. Each player is going to get three or four cards, depending on your player count. And you are going to silently, without communicating, play those cards around that clock face, trying to make sure you're following all of those mm-hmm. rules. With the exception that you can play a total of like three or four cards face up collectively, but you don't get to decide, because there's no communicating, you don't get to sort of ask permission to do that.
Yeah.
A player just has to do it.
You just decide that I'm going to play this card face up because I think it's important that
everyone knows that there is a three here, for example.
Uh-huh.
So that's the very basic setup. The way it twists that is that each level of the game contains sort of like four individual sub-challenges, which are different discs that have different little rules that you have to follow. So you could have one, for example, that says only one white card can be played in this slot.
Yep.
Or one that says the total value for this segment must be between 8 and 12 or something like that.
So it starts to like limit you in terms of being like, okay, well then this has to be this.
Yes.
So it means you have to be way more cautious about what cards you're playing and way more careful about how you're communicating, what you're communicating.
Yes. And then each one of the different sleeves, because there's a total of 40 levels divided between like 10 or something.
I mean, this is an amazing thing to open and look at.
Oh, it's lovely.
Has big like legacy game like energy, and the fact that you open it up and there's just like 40 different envelopes with things in.
There's like 10 envelopes with like
400 envelopes. No, all right, but still, it's a whole bunch of envelopes, and you just think, what's all this?
And I almost, I mean, it's like it's a weird thing because spoiler doesn't really make sense to say spoiler because it's all mechanical, but like it does start to do very interesting things with how it limits you. Each sort of chapter, each one of these sleeves that have all these big sort of challenges in, each one of them has a different name and a different theme, and they will force you to kind of communicate in different ways or like play cards in different ways and broadly like try and make sure that you get through these puzzles. And they're really intriguing things to try and pick apart. And I love how the game has the system for success and failure is so interesting. In the rulebook, it's like, you've won take time when you beat all 40 levels.
Yep.
And you cannot lose take time.
No.
You lose if you give up, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you put it away forever. But whenever you play a mission, you can basically retry it as many times as you want. Mm-hmm. If you choose to skip it, then you put it in the sleeve of regret.
Yeah.
But there's no consequence to putting things in the sleeve of regret.
Again, I think, like, I like this system. What it feels to me is it feels very, again, actually, feels video gamey, but in a different way. It feels like video game, like good video game tutorial like design of the fact that what it does is you go, okay, here's the four missions, you go through them, and it's like, hey, any of the ones that you failed, put into the sleeve of regrets.
Yeah.
And you don't have to play them again now, you just carry on.
Yeah.
Go to the next level. But it says that next time you start the game, next time you unbox the game, before you go into the current level you're at,
You have to go
through the sleeve levels. So I think what it is it's feels important because, like any good puzzle video game, it needs to walk you through it. And so each of these different like envelopes is almost adding new ways that you need to think about the puzzle.
Yes.
And it means if you don't get it early on, like what you're supposed to do, how you're supposed to do this, you're not going to be able to do things later on.
Yes.
So it's kind of a clever way of making sure that the game is doable.
Yeah.
Of being like, you still haven't quite got this. So you have to keep thinking about it.
There's also this really fascinating aspect that we didn't actually get that into when we played it at PAX, but I've since played it with a bunch of people who've really engaged with this part of the game. Because basically, the way that each of these challenges proceeds is you have an initial discussion phase, then you look at your cards, and then no communication, and you play out your cards around the thing, and then you have a resolution phase where you check to see if you did it. That discussion phase, we sort of breezed through it quite quickly when we played it at PAX. I found it fascinating playing it with one of my friends who took that discussion phase incredibly seriously and essentially designed kind of a new set of rules for us to follow before we'd even got our cards. So it was very much, oh, if we're going to play like this, if this, then this sort of statements
that
we put into play.
That cheating?
No, it's allowed. There's like, the game says specifically you can't do things like, if I'm holding an eight, I'll scratch my ear or something like that. Because it's you cannot communicate once you pick up the cards.
But you can say, no one is going to play a card higher than a six in
this
space.
Yeah, that's completely allowed. And you can say like, you should go first if you have a white one, two, or three. It should go in this space. And then when someone goes first, you can assume. Or if everyone's reticent to go first, you're gaining information. And you can kind of set up these like conditions before the game begins that you then kind of play with.
That helps with the deduction.
It does.
I think it is interesting that you've got like, you know, this deck of these two decks of ones, 12 and the black and white.
Yes.
Like they're not all going to be in play. But knowing that there are just like two ones and two twos, for example, with that sort of rule set, you can get to a point quite quickly where you go, oh, well, they're both there.
Yeah.
Like that's, you know, if you've come up with a system, then that's some information.
And that's what's kind of fascinating to me is that we had a really nice time playing Take Time at PAX. Like we enjoyed it as a co-op game. But I think what has made me kind of delighted by it and continuing to play it is that there's so much more to it than I thought.
Yeah.
Or the game is different to what I thought it was.
Yeah, well, we clearly knew we were getting something wrong, right?
yeah, that's true.
Because we were playing it and we were doing real badly in a way that it was like, we're missing something.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was one of those things, it was the end of the con, we were tired, and it was just like, it's very likely that we are just being stupid here.
Yes.
We may have missed a major rule, but I think we were just being stupid. And it's actually, I think we might have been just being too good, you know, in terms of like, I would assume that sort of conversation wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
But then actually, like, no, I'm thinking that based on other games like The Mind.
Yeah.
Whereas if you do that, you break the whole game.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like, there's so many more factors that you do need to be aware of, especially 100%. As it goes, that it's okay. Like,
yeah. And I think that is the game in a weird way. Like it puts some stress on it in the manual. It's like that you discuss the nature of the challenge. And I think that's where like a lot of the really interesting
wink,
stuff
wink,
lies.
Nudge, nudge.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to play a lot more of this. I think it's really good. And I think that I kept referring to it as being like The Mind, but I think it is on the Mind to the Crew spectrum. It's much more Crew than Mind, to me at least. It really feels like a game that has that same like ramping complexity of the Crew where you realize things about the systems or little nuances or little tricks you can pull the more and more you play it, which, it's like very good puzzle video game design, but in a cooperative board game, which is kind of amazing.
I think that just calling it the sleeve of regret is very funny. It sounds slightly like a euphemism for sad people, but also like I think it is a smart way. It's not ideal being like, hey, keep doing these puzzles over and over again.
Sure.
And it's something that in, you know, puzzle video games, they do in a more subtle ways. Like, you know, I think I've recently, after 6.5 years of playing it intermittently and not looking up in the line, I finally finished Baba Is You.
Congratulations.
Which was a recommendation that was given to us by a friend of the show. But again, that's very clever in the fact that like, There are a few bits where it stumbles, trying to do some really audacious stuff and introducing really weird new rules.
Right.
Largely, it will be like, it will give you all of the clues you need to be able to work out what the thing you need to do is.
Yes.
And then once it's done that, it will like reinforce that. It will be like, okay, we've just taught you how to do something new.
Yeah. Do it
now
again.
Now we're going to have you do that a few times so you really were sure you get it.
And this has, it's exactly the same thing. It's like each of those sort of chapters will contain a bunch of challenges that just seems kind of impossible until you do them, and then you're like, oh right, I've learned something about these systems. And that's just, it's so satisfying.
But it's funny for a game that doesn't have any kind of narrative or story that you think there's no issue with people dropping in and out, but actually it is something that you require, you play with the same group of people.
I think so,
because otherwise, like, I think, like, worst case scenario, you drop someone into it and you're immediately quarterbacking them for the whole game and getting annoyed when they don't understand the intricacies that you understand.
You're making your sort of rule set, but it's directed just for them.
Or like best case scenario, it's like they suddenly like teleported into a film where people are playing like a fictional game.
Right.
And it's like, oh, of course, the six must be placed on King's Leg 4, you know, in a way that's like, this isn't a real game. You're just making up stuff.
That's Take Time. It's real good.
It's clearly very cool, very special. I think, Tom, a recommendation for you, stop showing it to people.
I'll stop showing it
and
to
just
people.
Play it with the same people.
Myself. Oh, yeah, or other people.
I feel
like
it's the sort of thing that's just good to get people as a gift. It's a small enough thing that you just be like, just buy it for people and say, hey. And they go, oh, hey, Tom, maybe we can play it together. And you say, no.
No, buddy.
You must do this on your own as you lock the door and put them into the cellar where they're also not allowed to play Twilight Inscription.
Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We will be back next week with a podcast where we're going to buffet-style gorge ourselves with a whole bunch of little games.
That was me licking all of the sandwiches and scotch eggs at the buffet.
That
I'm sorry.
So good. In the meantime, if you want to support Shut Up and Sit Down, then you can find us on our website or our Patreon. You can become a donor to the site, keep us going, keep us trucking, and get a whole bunch of bonus stuff.
Yep.
I have done my top 5 games of the year, and Matt has done the same.
I have.
That's 10 games, and you even did some extras.
I did. I did some extra little contenders. Like, so yeah, we've done a whole bunch of stuff. Tom even did an amazing video last year in the last newsletter, which was him going through the cupboard of like our in-tray, things that we are going to be playing in the coming months, which is really a fantastic first look at stuff that you'll be seeing on the website in the future. Yep. So in the last newsletter, which you'll get access to, all donors get access to all the newsletters, so you will get the most recent newsletter with Tom's incredible rundown of his 5 games of 2025. And then the next newsletter coming very, very soon, if not imminently, you will be getting my 5 games of 2025.
It's Treat City.
Just a little thing to say thank you for people who
Treat
support
yourself
what we do.
And also us.
We'll see you again in a couple of weeks with our ramble through all of the games we sort of remember from PAX Unplugged 2020-2025.
That's a lot of games. Bye.